Good afternoon. It's my very great pleasure and pleasant duty this afternoon to introduce you to Wendy Pratt-Lugier. Wendy is currently university librarian and McKnight Presidential Professor at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. During her distinguished career, she's been involved in many pioneering digital library projects, notably during her time at the University of Michigan. Among her many distinctions, she's currently Vice Chair of CLEAR, the Council on Library and Information Resources, and is President of the Digital Library Federation. We are indeed privileged to have Wendy with us here today. It might be true to say that in the past, many of our libraries have operated almost autonomously within our institutional frameworks and infrastructure, and have perhaps focused on collections rather than services. Now, however, in an age where budgetary constraints are a constant challenge and the library has to prove that it is relevant in the digital age, it is more important than ever that the library's strategic aims are aligned with those of the institution and that services are tailored properly to user needs. Wendy, I'm delighted to ask you to deliver your keynote address, Aligning the Library as a Strategic Asset.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. The sort of closing act, if you will, I stand between you and the reception, so I'll try not to take advantage of that. As was suggested, I've been involved in digital library activity for almost two decades, and my own career, I think, has in some respects paralleled the kind of development we've all felt about the landscape in which we live. That is to say, early on, so much of what we did was focused on digital content, and then evolved to be more about the technologies that underlie the content. And then finally, and that's the stage I think that I find myself in now, and I suspect you do too, I'm much more concerned about the roles that we play in a digital age and how we instrumentally use those roles, integrating the technologies and integrating the content, and really reconceiving what a library can be. Now, I'll have to admit, I write a lot and speak a lot about the kinds of themes that this conference focuses on, but this is the first opportunity where I've been asked to give a case study, if you will, about my own institution, the University of Minnesota. And it's not that there's any shortage of material to talk about. In fact, just last week, we were named the Library of the Year for the American Library Association's Excellence Award in University Libraries. The problem, really, and if you think about it from your own institutions, how do you highlight the things that are most salient to the themes we're talking about? How do you create and share a coherent plan about an overall organization that you know only too well for its pluses and its minuses? And how do you highlight those things that can be generalized to all of your institutions and make my remarks things that will hopefully help you when you return home? So that's my challenge, and I'll warn you that I have way too many slides, but many of them have URLs with full reports behind some of the work that I'll be talking to you about. Now, what I want to do is to frame my remarks in the context of a paradigm. That is to say that we are reconceiving the way in which we form our worldview about what libraries are and what their roles are to be. And if I were to change that subtitle, I'm going to try to bookend these remarks with starting with Copernicus, and we all know what paradigm he shifted, the fact that the Earth revolved around the sun as opposed to being a fixed object. And I'll end with another philosopher, I guess you could say, Thomas Friedman. I hope you all have read The World is Flat, another worldview that he's trying to put in place. So those are going to be my ways of trying to get you to understand and to engage in this concept of paradigm shift. Now, I'm going to start with a quote of one of my own. Back in 2002, I wrote a paper entitled Diffuse Libraries, and the main points were really to draw attention to the fact that with distributed technologies and open paradigms, the library had an extraordinary opportunity to be involved in all stages of the scholarly process, from the knowledge creation and dissemination and use. And rather than being defined by collections, which is what we really traditionally have been defined by, that we really have an opportunity to become a diffuse agent within our communities. Now, I noted that I want to frame this as a paradigm shift, and just to make sure we all understand that construct, a paradigm is simply a conceptual model to think about the underlying theories and practices of a profession. And it's a generally accepted worldview, if you, so to speak. Now, I hope a book that I know I was forced to read in college, Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, I think is relevant here, and that he talks about when you get to a point where the profession can no longer stand the anomalies, the things that just don't fit into your current worldview, then you begin to subvert tradition and practice. And it leads you to a new set of commitments. And that's the practice, setting the stage for a new practice of science. And that's what I want to do today, to convey to you that we've reached that point where we're making new commitments and we have experienced the anomalies. So let me first frame what I mean by the paradigm shift with some very specific changes I think have happened to all of us. First of all, we used to have a focus on collections, a collection-centric worldview. And now we're increasingly focused on our expertise, what we can bring to the table within our communities. In the past, we were very focused on publications, the artifacts of scholarship. But as we've heard today in a number of talks, and I suspect we'll hear in the coming days, the increasing focus is on process and how you support process, everything from the germ of an idea in the mind of a scientist to the gathering of material to executing it in some form of research. We're moving from a sense that our role is about control, and represented here by a catalog record, to a sense that our responsibility really is about sense-making, to take that messy universe of information and make sense of it, not just for the community as a whole, but relevant to the point just a minute ago about portals. It's our responsibility to make sense of the environment for particular communities because we have the capacity to do that now. And we also have the capacity to help people understand the environment, that is to say, to derive meaning between the elements in it. In the past, our services have been focused much more about mediation. The user comes with an inquiry and we mediate it with the collection. And now we're much more talking about being an enabling force. I've used the example here of Zotero software, which helps a user interact with the internet and extract things that are of relevance and manage them over time. It's really an enabling tool and enabling function. And lastly, we're used to serving a local community. If you think about it, all of our licenses are focused on our local user communities. Our services are targeted at that primary audience. But increasingly, our users, our scholars, are interacting within a global community and conducting their scholarship, really, in research groups that span the continents. Now, what I want to do, and that's the sort of sense of the paradigm shifts that we've been experiencing, I want now to turn to talking about how to position a discrete organization, my own as an example. And I'm going to do so by giving you three highlights, if you will, that I think each carries with it a slightly different message. The first one is about assessment. That is to say, if we're going to support processes of scholarship, we need to understand what those processes are. So I will share with you some research we've conducted to assess users and understand just what they are trying to accomplish. The second example deals with engagement. how do we engage a user community to better understand what's happening in the landscape and to really take advantage of the changes that are unfolding? It's not just about the technology, but as you'll see from the example I will use, it's about getting them to understand what options they have in publishing, in open access, in the kind of policy infrastructure that surrounds scholarship. And then lastly, I'm going to conjoin those two, this notion of assessment and engagement, and talk about a potential role the library can play as catalyst, that is to say, really shaping the environment for the future and really working with what are often called virtual communities or online communities. So as a little bit of background, my own institution's relatively young compared to some here in Europe, been around since 1850, 5 campuses. The main one is in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, a very large student body, over 50,000 students. And the libraries are spread across 14 libraries on a very geographically distributed campus, over 6 million volumes and 360 staff. Now, the institution itself has, in the last 3 to 4 years, been engaged in its own process of strategic positioning, and some 400 faculty were engaged in over 35 task forces to really understand the changes that were taking place within the academy and make recommendations how the university could uniquely position itself in a stature context. It's not about ranking, but how they could be preeminent in certain areas. Some of the outcomes, there's many, but the ones that I will highlight, the recommendations included new institutional structures, combining colleges to help enable interdisciplinary and collaborative science and scholarship, a focus on learning outcomes to identify 7 skills that a student ought to have by the time they graduate. And some of those skills relate very much to what the library can provide in terms of understanding the origins of information, how it can be used, how authentic it is, those sorts of issues. And then a high premium placed on interdisciplinary scholarship and the kinds of infrastructure needed to support it. Now, when you're thinking about a paradigm shift, both at the institutional level, but also bringing it now closer to home to the library, we have a challenge. And as Kuhn talks about here, Copernicus's innovation was not simply that he was able to move the Earth in terms of beginning to change that paradigm of what happened between the Earth and the Sun, but it was a whole new way of looking at problems. And it was one that necessarily changed the meaning of words, earth, and motion. So similarly, we need to think about how we convey our mission, our vision, the kinds of paradigms within we work, and need to think about the language that we use. So I was quite proud when the staff of our library 5 years ago came up with our new vision statement. Now, most traditional vision statements would say something like the library role is to acquire, preserve, manage, and disseminate content or collections. But you'll notice here 2 very key parts to our vision statement. One is that we think we have intellectual leadership to bring to the campus in areas like intellectual property, copyright, information literacy, for example. And secondly, our job is not about content, but it's about the information experience. That is to say, that interaction between the content and the user's needs, and that we aim to provide extraordinary information experience. Now, I'll tell you privately that the staff who came up with this vision statement stole it from an ice cream shop in town that had as their motto that we provide extraordinary ice cream experiences. So. But it fits, doesn't it? And the way that we engage in this vision is that we inspire learning and discovery through content, through collaboration, and again, our expertise. Now I'm going to move on to these 3 examples. And the first one is a little bit on the long side, but then the other 2 all shorter. I'll warn you of that. So the first one's about assessment. And it involves talking about 2 major studies we've conducted over 2 years to understand scholar behavior. And the main things I want you to see in this example is the methodologies used in assessing behavior, but also for us the importance of establishing an analytic framework to look at the data, not only for our own benefit, but for the user community to explain to them what we learned about them. And also then as we develop services in response to those data, that we do it in a very iterative design process where we continually engage the user community. So the studies I'm going to be reporting on, there's two URLs at the bottom here, and there's lengthy reports on both of them. They were conducted, first of all, in the humanities and social sciences, and then followed up in the sciences. And it involved this iterative process of getting data about their users, creating an analytic framework, beginning to develop services in response to the data, and then going back and engaging the community to find out if we were successful. In the humanities and social sciences, we conducted extensive interviews with over 1,200 graduate students and faculty, and then did surveys with a smaller subset. When it came to the scientists, they said, no surveys, please. So we only did interviews. But both of the processes looked at four things: the research practices of the community, how interdisciplinary and collaborative their research was, how did they manage the stuff that happens when you do scholarship, the books, the papers, the CDs, you name it. And then lastly, a little bit about their interaction with the library. Now, I'm not going to go into the many, many results that we found, but most of these are self-evident, I think. We've learned that the scholars in humanities and social sciences wanted everything digital. They wanted to be mobile in getting access to it. They wanted their research used a variety of media. In fact, one surprising statistic was over 50% of them said they used archives, which was interesting. Importantly, they told us that their methods for conducting scholarship in the print milieu did not translate into the digital, and they were having trouble crossing that divide. And most significantly, they didn't know what to do with all of the materials they gathered in the process of their research. They wanted to collaborate more, but were challenged. And then many of them, well over half, said they had unique collections or data that they would like to share. Now, interestingly, the scientists told us many similar things, but their problem was in the discovery side was not so much finding things, but keeping up with their discipline. To the extent that they were interdisciplinary, they didn't know the language of the other disciplines. They, too, had problems managing their research materials, especially their data. And for them, information was a significant information resource. So they wanted, essentially, us to figure out how to catalog people so that we could reveal to the community what was interesting about their colleagues. Now, I mentioned the second important stage was to develop an analytic framework, and this meant to look at all of the data we had and come up with some core behaviors that we called primitives that really represented the stages of the research process, and then to look at the data and the tasks that people were doing and to see how they related to those primitives, and then to begin to look at what kinds of services and tools would speak to those particular tasks, and then to start prototyping the services. Now, here's where I'm going to warn you. The next graph starts to get really messy. Don't try to look at the particulars of it, but I'm going to highlight some of the things that I want to draw your attention to. We start with the four primitive behaviors that represent the stages in a research process. First, you try to discover information. Then you gather it into your environment. You use it to create something new, and then you share it. That seems simple enough, right? But then we began to look at the data within the tasks within each behavior. So within the discovering, people wanted serendipitous finding, that is to say, browsing the stacks. They also wanted structured finding. They wanted to be able to use databases and tools. In the gathering behavior, they, of course, were collecting information, but also trying to figure out how to organize it. In the create primitive, they were interested in annotating and reviewing and describing things as well as the writing process. And then finally, in the sharing stage, they had to be concerned with copyright and intellectual property rights. They often shared in the teaching context or in publishing. Now, here's the messy data. And again, don't have to look at all of it, but these are just showing you data points that related to each of these tasks. And let me highlight three in particular. So on the far right, you have 73% of the respondents said that they could really use help organizing their material. It was a mess. They had things on their hard drives, in their filing cabinets, you name it. They were highly reliant on their colleagues for recommendations on sources they should use, but didn't know how sometimes to tap people they didn't know about. They were also very concerned about collaborating with individuals at other institutions, but didn't really have anything other than the telephone or the internet as mechanisms to work with them. The next stage was this process of brainstorming services that we could implement for these tasks. And again, I'm not going to go through all of them, but highlight three. All of those people that wanted help organizing their material, perhaps we could create some sort of personal information management system. Or the individuals that wanted to learn more about the opinions and the recommendations of their colleagues, perhaps we could rely on social bookmarking and tagging and recommender systems. And those that wanted to work with colleagues across the globe, perhaps we could develop some tools that would help them collaborate more effectively. So I'm going to share with you one of the results of those data. And this was a kind of portal within our university's portal system. Within the portal, there is a tab for the library. And what we began to develop was a way to bring together in a component-based way all the tools and content that a user might want. And based on who the user was, and this gets at the question earlier, what their disciplinary background was, what their role was, we push out different information to them. And we further let them customize the environment further if they would like to add other things, and to make the environment portable so they can take the resources and tools into their other network contexts like iGoogle. And then over time, since we're capturing all the behavior, can't we take those behavioral data and begin to shape the environment for the user? And I hope I can make clear to you what this actually means. Most of this is based on work we've done with affinity strings, and at the bottom there's a citation to a recent journal article about them. But essentially, every person on our campus has this kind of coding associated with their identity that tells us what campus they're on, what discipline they're associated with, what degree program they're going towards, and what their role is. And we use those data. There's over close to 10,000 different affinities that we manage. We match them with what roles people are playing. Are they a graduate student, a lower division freshman, etc.? And then we match them with pre-identified sets of core resources that might be relevant to them. Now, where it gets messy, here you have a list of the most frequently used journals, and that top one is the Academic Health Center, all the health science professions. We can look at what journals they use, and we can see the most frequently used items. And then we can begin to look at individual titles and see who else uses them. So you see the point here. We have data not only about what an individual department perhaps uses, but what other related departments use. And we can begin to shape what people see based on related disciplines or people that are like them. So what is pushed out to the user is a component-based view of the library that has not only the core resources in the area, so this is happens to be someone in biophysics, tools that we offer, such as the campus blogging service or how to find citations. But further, they can customize it and add things that are important to them, and they can push it out to the network. For the undergraduate user that may not have a sense of what discipline they want to work within, we have a number of tools, not only ties to their courses, but a fun little tool that we release open source called the Assignment Calculator that lets the student put in the topic of their research project, put a deadline in, and then the tool will step them through the phases of the research process, tell them what resources would be good for them, and then based on their deadline, start emailing them, telling them it's time to get working on stage two or stage three. Very popular. Now I'm going to turn to this second example on engagement. And here it's really about scholarly communication and how we help the user community, the campus community, better understand the policies. And the key things that I want you to take away from this little case study is, first of all, a very different organizational model, not within the typical divisions of the library. How we helped the staff develop the skills to be more outward directed, how we leveraged the opinion leaders on campus, and how we built the infrastructure to help them engage in new forms of publishing. So this new organizational construct, and we use them in a number of different ways, is called a collaborative. It draws from across the libraries from different sectors. We spent a lot of time educating the staff and building tools for them, but the focus of this scholarly communication collaborative is really on policy issues surrounding publishing and sharing your work, authors' rights, copyright, the like. We also conducted a massive environmental assessment looking at who published where, what the policies were of the primary journals within each discipline, and identified faculty who were editors or had published in open access or anything that gave us an indication that they might be concerned about these issues. And then lastly, developed services, both education and consulting services and technology infrastructure. On the staff side, we started by bringing in experts for a number of workshops, did the environmental scan, but then we also gave each of the subject librarians tools that they could take out to work with the academic departments. PowerPoint presentations, handouts, we gave them this author's rights is an online video that walks the user through the basic principles of author's rights. We developed templates for publishing agreements that the librarians could take out and work with faculty on. And then we began to engage the advocates and help them help us, if you will, to talk about the issues, to bring awareness, and to take action. On the education and consultation side, we've established, we have ongoing blogs and RSS feeds about the issues. We've established a copyright and publishing center, the online tools and templates, and then in addition, repository services. Essentially, an institutional repository with a slightly different twist. That is to say, it takes our role as the university archive and takes it forward into the digital age. So we're also collecting all of the digital publications and digital works of the campus itself and of academic units, as well as archiving faculty works. The work that we've done has recently been featured by the Association of Research Libraries, and if at this URL you can find a toolkit for any library to use to establish such a program and how to work from the developmental stage to the action plan. Okay, the third case study, the last one, the catalyst role. Now this one, as I said, tries to bring together that which we have done, which is assessment, but tries to bring it to a particular user community. It's also about how we engage with experts. In this case, most of the work is being done with computer scientists, especially those who do work in online communities and recommender systems. This is our first attempt to really develop systems and services that will be useful to the whole globe for a particular community and give them the kind of social tools to interact with one another and hopefully work towards a model that will sustain it for the future. Now, I don't know if the word virtual community means something to you, but in the United States, there was a recent publication by the National Science Foundation talking about this new challenge, which is really about how do we bring understanding to the ways in which a community works, how it communicates, what its trust mechanisms are, and how it operates in an online environment. And how do we develop models that can be used across the disciplines? And that's what this project is all about. It's called Ethics Share. It's dealing with the field of practical ethics, and in particular bioethics, funded by the Mellon Foundation. It's looking to build a place for bioethicists, which is a relatively young discipline, to come together, build a community online, and begin to interact with content and tools, and to figure out if we can come up with a model that will not just sustain the technology, but sustain the community. How do we get people to contribute, the tagging, the all sorts of social features? Now, bioethics, for those that aren't familiar with it, is really the study of human values as it relates to the health professions and health services. It draws on an enormous diversity of other disciplines, religion, philosophy, government information, legislation, commission reports, and of course the health professions as well. What we learned in the assessments we've done of this community, and there have been numerous over the last year, assessments, focus groups, surveys, is they wanted high-quality content, but from this broad diversity of content areas. Of course, they wanted the full text, not just the citations. They wanted to have a place where they could come together and really engage as a community. And they wanted a private place, a place where they as individuals could conduct their research. Now, if you were to put together the analytic model for this particular project, this is what it would look like. We're interested first in how we bring the right content to this virtual community. How do we harvest content from any possible source on the internet, licensed or not, from all of those disciplines, bring the citations together, and then resolve them to the appropriate copies for the institutional home of that of a user. Then how do we look at the discovery tools they need when there are going to be multiple disciplines and vocabularies involved? And how do we not do it all in a handcrafted way, but rely on machine technologies to develop some of the description? How do we then engage? How do we engage with the community and develop the tools that will enable them to participate? And then lastly, and importantly, how do we develop governance structures that will help them move forward over time, sustain the contributions, figure out what's appropriate, what kind of privacy policies, and, of course, intellectual property policies? So the system will be released in a week. We've been in test mode for a while. It's based on Drupal, for those of you who care about the technologies. Has the repository functions. It has harvesting functions that are all going to be made open source so that you can use them in other settings. It has this multi-institutional resolution service we've developed working with OCLC. Has faceted search capabilities, has recommendations and tagging and ratings, and again tries to take the user behavior and allow it to drive what happens in the environment. And because this is a community like many that comes together in conferences, that we want to make sure and feature events and have blogging capability. But the big question, of course, is the sustainability question. I'm not going to demo it for you, but it has sort of a lot of the features that you would expect, searching capabilities, advanced search, a kind of calendaring effect to see what your colleagues are doing when, the ability to collaborate and discuss around content. And then the tagging feature is very interesting in that we are using a controlled vocabulary, but then let the machine suggest some things to you based on a content analysis, and then let users contribute their own tags. So that you have this very rich mix of descriptive information based on the community's interest. A legitimate question, I think, is what is the library's role in a virtual community? Are we the people to select the content, to preserve it, to develop the tools, to integrate the content and tools? Or can we take it a step further and really be a catalyst within the community and use the behavior to, I'm going to use a word I don't like to, but manipulate, to really help them better understand a broader horizon and to get them to contribute more? And a lot of the computer science research that we're working with is about that. How do you get people who might be reticent to contribute to contribute? And then, of course, there are the sustainability issues of who hosts the community, who contributes. Some of our early assessment work, the older faculty said they would never think of contributing new content to the system. That was something for staff to do. The younger faculty told us, we want to contribute, we want to comment, we want to share with each other. So there's been a significant generational difference in this community. And are the roles that the library can play exclusive roles, or are they collaborative roles? Now, I told you I was going to start with Copernicus and end with Thomas Friedman. I hope some of you, all of you, have read The World is Flat, a very different worldview. And what I like about Friedman's work is that he identifies what kind of people we need to work in this new worldview, the kind of global economy, the kind of 24/7 economy. And he says we need people of a few very distinct sorts, people who are collaborators, who know how to manage complexity, people who are synthesizers that know how to create unexpected mashups or bringing unexpected things together in new ways. People that are explainers who bring disparate things together and turn complexity into simplicity. Localizers who adapt global infrastructure for local needs. And then lastly, leveragers, people who know how to bring together the right people, resources, and ideas to maximize and move beyond the current state. And isn't that what we are trying to achieve in the kinds of shifts that I've described to you today? This is the kind of staff we need and the kind of skills that we need to nurture in our staff. Now I'm going to, in my final slides here, first of all, bring you back to the notion of a paradigm and what Kuhn says. He talks about that when there's that shift in the paradigm where extraordinary episodes in which you begin to see your professional commitments shifting, those he calls revolutions. They are the tradition-shattering complements to the tradition-bound activity of normal science. So in closing here, I thought I would try to find a way that would convey to all of us, regardless of what language we speak or what we understand, that revolution and what's happening. And what I hope to show you is that we are challenged to build simplicity out of complexity, to sustain our core roles, but to do it in a way that adds value and that can really enhance and enlighten the scholarly process. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Wendy. That was certainly a most challenging talk. I'd like to invite questions from the floor. Graham.
I would like to ask, and first of all, thank you for an inspiring presentation. I would like to ask, how has the revolution shattered your organizational structure within the library? Have you reorganized the library? Are people working on these exciting new projects, or do you still have staff doing circulation and stamping books and all the rest of it?
It's really changed in a number of ways. On the one hand, you look at our organizational chart, and there are some traditional elements. So we have most of the people that provide core support to academic disciplines divided by subject, pretty much. But then I mentioned that we use these collaborative structures so that when we engage in a process like Scholarly Communication Collaborative. We have another one for e-science. We have another one for information literacy. And we have another one that's dealing with essentially web services and discoverability. They all draw from across the library, from the technologists to the catalogers to the people that provide academic support. I think one of the fundamental changes, though, is how we perceive the role of the people who are the subject librarians, the people that are out there working with the disciplines. We've engaged in a huge amount of process improvement so that a good deal of the core collection development is handled by vendors. We've freed up their time so that they are expected to spend most of it outward directed, involved in teaching, involved in the kinds of scholarly communication activity that we talked about, and helping people with their data, helping engage within research. And that has been a fundamental shift. Similarly, on what people used to call technical services. We've done a lot of process improvement working with vendors so that most of those folks are being redirected to engage much more in how you manage the digital environment and bring data in, manipulate it in various ways. So there's a lot of new roles, but again, the organizational chart probably looks a little bit similar.
Perhaps I may follow up there. You mentioned how you'd encourage staff to interact with faculty and so on and so forth. But I just wondered to what extent you'd found any resistance or lack of ability to change in what you have done about it.
Could you say the last part again? I didn't quite hear you.
Have you met with any resistance from staff to these changes, or indeed a lack of ability to be able to change, and how have you dealt with those human resources issues?
You're talking about how the resources have shifted in response?
I'm talking about library staff.
The library staff itself. I'm sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Sorry, the acoustics up here are not good.
I mean, I think one thing I would say is that the we have seen a real shift, too, in the general composition of the staff, much more skilled experts in particular areas. We haven't moved towards something that some colleagues that I'm associated with at University of Michigan are beginning to, instead of advertising for particular positions, they're advertising for the kinds of people they want, the kind of freedmen list, and then seeing what they get in response to that. So I think there are some shifts, if that responds to your question.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Are any further questions, please?
I can hardly pass up the last opening, Wendy, without asking, what should we who manage library schools do to prepare people for this Friedman-type list? That's, you know, training people in specific skills is straightforward. Making people who are ready for paradigm shift is a challenge.
It is. In some respects, and I don't mean to sound this as an ageist comment, but some of the younger folks coming out of iSchools or library schools, whatever you call them, they bring the technology skills you need. And so they are more agile and more comfortable sometimes in that respect. But they lack the organizational skills that come with experience. So I think we've tried often to pair people so that there's a complementarity of what they bring. So on the one hand, I think you can prepare them with the skill side, but you can't give them that which only experience brings to the table. I think the other thing that has been revolutionary, if you will, for all of our staff is that when we did these original surveys, they were quite surprised that we weren't asking about how people use the library. I think there were one or two questions. But we asked them, how do you do your own work? And the construct was the most recent scholarly project you have worked on. Use it as an example. Tell us how you engaged in the work. So rather than having the staff anticipate and assume that they knew what the researcher wanted or the student wanted, it was quite revealing for them to see what people were really trying to do. So it was a way of lighting some light bulbs, if you will, in staff to let go of the preconceived notions that they had learned the right way to do things. But I'm not sure there's an easy answer to what should iSchools do. I do think internship opportunities certainly convey a lot, but getting that organizational dimension and in the context of the academy is really hard.
We have time perhaps for one final question. Yes.
I found your approach organizing focus groups very interesting because that's a way to get the users involved. But I know that organizing focus groups is quite some effort, especially regarding the heterogeneous character of a large university. So I wonder, how did you manage, how many groups did you organize?
I have two words for you. Free food. We had the librarian staff and also deans identify faculty that might be interested or graduate students that might be interested, and then we just contacted them and said, please come for lunch, well, free pizza, whatever. The woman that did all of the interview work was a postdoctoral person whose background was of an anthropological or cultural studies, and that really helped because she didn't bring the library baggage to the table, but rather knew from a scholarly point of view how to look at different communities. So it wasn't an overwhelming number. I think in the humanists and social scientists, we maybe did about 75 to 100 people in focus groups, and in the scientists, it was more like 50 or 60. But when you begin to hear the same things over and over, you begin to have some resonance that you're tapping the right problems. And then when you had our survey data with 1,200 target users, and we had a response rate well over 50%. So we had very good data from the survey as well.
Thank you very much, Wendy. And perhaps you'd join with me in thanking Wendy once again.